So thank you very much. I guess it's up to me to give the long and boring presentation. I hope it won't be too long and boring. I have a little slide up here, and it indicates, I'm not actually going into this, you'll see it at the end again, but it'll indicate the two sources that I'll be quoting from. That the one is the TLP, meaning the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus by Wittgenstein, and then sometimes I'll also quote from his notebooks that he wrote prior to this work. So these are the notebooks between 1914 to 16. But anyway, I'm taking this away now. You'll get to see it again at the end. And I'll actually move into the presentation. And as you can see already from the title of the presentation, this is a very wordy PowerPoint presentation, in part so that you can ask me to send it to you, if I'm going too slowly, or if you want to double check on things or critique them, I'll be glad to share it with you. It's almost a manuscript. But as you can see from the title of the presentation, I'm talking about a book that doesn't exist, and it's not the book, the Tractatus Technico-Philosophicus. And this book, it's not just that it doesn't exist because Wittgenstein never quite got to finishing it or something like that. It's a book that he didn't even start writing and that he probably wouldn't have written. But that in some sense he could have and should have written. So in other words, by putting it up here as a kind of desideratum, you know, that we might want to have this book, I'm actually trying to identify a deficit. And this is what my talk is about, to identify the deficit. We are missing this book. And I want to talk about what this deficit consists in, and I will try to take at least one or two steps towards filling this deficit. And of course, it's a huge deficit, and so it's a huge project that I'm trying to engage in here. And I hope I'm not going to overtax you by being too superficial. This might be the way that I overtax you. I will not assume a whole lot about Wittgenstein. I'll try to, whatever we need to know about Wittgenstein, I'll try to present that as we go along. But I might overtax you just by being too quick on certain things. But normally I'm too quick because I just haven't figured it out yet, so I can't really tell you anymore. So anyway, all right. So what is the deficit that we are talking about? Okay, there's on the one hand this deficit and concerns Wittgenstein. In recent years, there have been numerous studies on Wittgenstein as engineer. It doesn't matter now whether I fully agree with them or not. I'll just take them as a point of departure. They suggest that not only his early work, but throughout, he had an engineering way of doing philosophy. I'm thinking about work by Kelly Hamilton, by Susan Scarrett, and others. Indeed, you know, this engineering approach to doing philosophy may be actually one of the important and original features of Wittgenstein's way of doing philosophy. And yet, I think Wittgenstein had nothing actually to say about technology. And there's a reason why he couldn't and didn't. And where he employs an engineering idiom, or where he works in this kind of engineering style, he takes technology as something intellectual and not the material interaction of things in the technological context. That's one deficit. So there's a kind of blind spot towards technology. And there's the same blind spot, actually, in the philosophy of science. So it's actually not just one deficit, it's two deficits that I'm talking about, but they work in tandem. So in recent years, philosophers of science have adopted a technological idiom in many respects, technological ways of speaking, and also considered technical aspects of experimentation and modeling. People are very enthusiastic, in fact, about this kind of turn to practice and technology. Some suggest that scientists work like engineers when they, for example, identify mechanisms and new theories or explanations, when they produce local fits between models and reality, right? When they replace truth by notions of robustness and reliability. So this is what I mean by technological idiom of philosophy of science. And yet, they have hardly anything to say about technology and technologically oriented research as we know it from pharmacy or chemistry, material science, or synthetic biology. Where they appear to be speaking about technical aspects of research, they are holding fast to a purely intellectual concept of knowledge, I would argue, and have almost nothing to say about knowledge production under the conditions of technology. And I'll try to explain this. So now, these two deficits, as I say, work in tandem, and I will try to show you as I go along where the important linkage is, and I think it's quite obvious because the philosophers of science that I'm talking about and Wittgenstein share a certain conception of what the problem of philosophy is. And this is a kind of a conception they inherited, well, you know, Heidegger would say from Descartes, I would say primarily from Kant and the Kantian tradition. And And this is a conception of metaphysics, it's a conception of what the problems of philosophy are, which has this blind spot towards technology. So there's another way to expressing these deficits, maybe a bit more pointedly. Even though Wittgenstein approaches his problems like an engineer, with these problems are not problems of engineering or technology, but concern the relation of language and world, for example. And even though philosophers of science adopt a technical idiom and consider instruments and experiments, they continue addressing the relationship of theory and reality, and they are mostly interested in the role instruments and experiments play in constructing agreement between theory and reality. In both cases, there is no interest in knowledge of the ways in which things interact and technical works or works of technology, as I call them here in a very preliminary way, and thus no interest in the knowledge that is being acquired and coveted in techno-scientific research. So there's a claim here that actually it's a blind spot regarding what science, what the problems of science and philosophy are as a metaphysical problem of agreement between theory and reality, but it's a blind spot at the same time about what science is, because science is being reduced as that which addresses this problem or that achieves this agreement between theory and reality. And I would argue that if you look around what we call our techno-scientific research, there's a lot of other modes of doing science that is not really concerned about theory development, it's not really concerned with hypothesis testing, it's not really concerned with forging agreement between theory and reality. Okay, so this is sort of my sort of general project and my program, and I want to do this now in three steps. And I will be talking mostly about Wittgenstein because I want to envision this alternative work. And I want to see actually whether engaging in this technological idiom and using it for himself, there's actually a lot there in Wittgenstein to help us write the book that he didn't write. So I would actually want to argue that there is quite a bit that we can draw on. So the paper or the presentation will focus primarily on Wittgenstein. And the story about the philosophy of science will run along as a kind of subtext that I will come back to it once in a while. So in the first step, I want to look at Wittgenstein's engineering mode of thinking and why it has nothing to do with technology and the material sense of things interacting in the context of a work. And then I want to, in the second step, show what the difference might be between Wittgenstein's philosophy of science and Wittgensteinian philosophy of technology. And what I want to show here is that that Wittgenstein reconstructs in his written work, the Tractatus Logicus Philosophicus, the possibility of describing the world scientifically by showing that facts are expressed in speech. So it's an ontology of facts, which is also the ontology of modern science. And the expression of facts is the program of, in some sense, the Tractatus. His philosophy of technology might have reconstructed the possibility of working knowledge, I would argue, which is knowledge of how things work together in a work, by showing that things are expressed in a work. So it would be more of an ontology of things. This comes back to our discussion yesterday a little bit. So this would be the kind of difference that I want to make, want to illustrate a little bit in my second step, and then finally I want to show what the consequences of this are, also for the larger project, the larger project of doing philosophy of science, and how it changes our image of science. Okay, so this is again, it's a mouthful and it's way too much for one presentation, so it's a somewhat sketchy program that I'm presenting. So let's begin with this first step. And so let me quickly indicate, just by one example, I mean, there are many ways of talking about Wittgenstein as an engineer, but let me just pick up on one strand of the argument that Wittgenstein pursues philosophy in a kind of engineering mode. And this this begins with a kind of more or less biographical fact or information that he came actually from engineering to philosophy, that he was an engineering student in Berlin and Manchester. And in Berlin, he was encountering especially one famous, very famous, broadly used textbook, and this was Franz Willow's Theoretical Kinematics. If you look at this textbook, and this is one of the arguments about Wittgenstein as an engineer, you see a kind of way of looking at, in some sense, you might call it the grammar of machine language, which may have influenced Wittgenstein quite significantly. So in Rouleau, you know, you have the notion that there is an alphabet of machine parts, And these are levers, gears, and so forth, a whole kind of library of parts. And to know a machine, or to be a good engineer, to know a machine part means, and that's what engineering has to learn primarily, is to see how these machine parts can interact. There are false and wrong ways of putting things together. How can machine parts work in the context with others in the context of a machine? So, and here Rouleau is quite literal, that as we put together machine parts, as we put together elements from that alphabet, we are creating, in some sense, sentences. And these sentences allow, in some sense, for machines to draw conclusions. They're rational machines. So, I mean, as you watch a machine, of course, a classical machine with gears and levers and cog wheels and so forth and so on, you can, in a way, follow how one bit of motion gets translated into the next and so forth, and you move rationally from input to an output. So this is the machine, as Rouleau talks about in his theoretical kinematics, and it leads to a way of teaching also engineering, which was extremely powerful and influential. Here you see, I think, at Cornell University, you know, they have this library of machine parts standing in their department. In many engineering departments, you can still see them, remnants of these. And there's one machine part here to the right, and you have this whole library, and in some sense, students learn how to work with these parts of the alphabet. And now, how does this, in some sense, reappear in a transformed way in the Tractatus? Here, again, I'm referring mostly to what other people have said about this. So, in Wittgenstein's picture theory of language, you have, in some sense, an alphabet of picture elements, picturing elements. There's, on the one hand, things. There's, on the other hand, words and names. And to know these elements means that how they can work in concert with others. So to know an object is to know how it can appear in possible facts. And to know a word or to know a name is to know how it can appear in possible sentences. How it can occur in sentences. And then, of course, this is an aspect that doesn't come out from Rouleau yet. You need other kinds of parts of engineering vocabulary here that you can establish representational relations between these kinds of concatenation of things or of words. So sentences can, in some sense, model other sentences, facts can model other facts, and so forth and so on, and sentences can model facts. Because any kind of assemblage of these alphabet parts into a meaningful structure has a certain logical structure, a logical form, and can be used to, they can be mapped onto each other in certain ways. All right, so this would be Wittgenstein's picture theory of language. But I think one of the interesting things to note about, I mean, this is late 19th century, 1875. You're talking about, people are talking about machines, we're talking about these ugly, you know, black, huge factories that were noisy and cruel and where people were dwarfed by machinery. And I mean, the machine as a topos in the 19th century, when you read Marx and so forth, there's nothing here. I mean, the machine is not made of steel and grease, it is not subject to wear and tear. I mean, Rouleau's machine has geometrical properties only. What Rouleau performs is explicitly a logical analysis, and he says his book makes a contribution primarily to logic. He says this. So as a philosopher of technology, and Rouleau was actually very influential on the formation of a new field called philosophy of technology. So Ernst Kapp, who wrote in German language, at least, the very first book called Philosophie der Technik. He wrote this 2 years after Rouleau and already has a whole long chapter dedicated to Rouleau. And so it works itself into Gehlen's and the anthropological conceptions of technology, ideas that somehow the advance of technology is an advance of projecting the human body and mind into the exterior world. So the machine is, in some sense, the final chapter in a history of technology where finally the brain, the human mind, is exteriorized into a kind of artifact. And Cassira refers very, very explicitly to Rouleau, and of course Wittgenstein appears to be influenced. So, but here Rouleau presented the engineer as a thinker, the machine as an image of ratiocination, not as an experienced thing, but really as a conceived object. So this is interesting, of course, and we might give a, this is just a kind of historical footnote. It is the same time when engineers and scientists establish themselves as a profession, like doctors and lawyers, and they have their museums of technology, they have their philosophies of science and of philosophies of technology and so forth. And at that time, they present themselves as men of thought, you know, they're intellectuals and not people who tinker and get their hands dirty. So the machine becomes dematerialized and intellectual, and that's how this kind of this is a kind of dematerialized intellectual way in which engineering works itself into Wittgenstein's philosophy. So all right, so how does engineering contribute to the Tractatus Logicus Philosophicus? So this is just a summary picture, very much simplified, of course, but actually it is almost that simple. and this is also for those who are not that familiar with the work. So he looks on the one hand at the world as a totality of facts. The world is the totality of facts, in other words, of these structured sort of entities, which consists of concatenation of things. From the set of all possible facts, it is the sum of all those that happen to be the case. So not all facts are the case, but those, the sum of all those facts that are the case is the world, right? And from the set of all possible sentences, it is the set of those that all happen to be true at any given time that give us a complete description of the world, right? So you can get a complete description of the world if you kind of just, in some sense, just in an almost enumerative way, kind of match all the true sentences to all the true facts at any given time. Right, and then you have a whole long list of all the true sentences that describe all the facts, and that's your description of the world, and that's what science does. And in some sense, with this combinatorial alphabet of machine parts or picture elements, and of course one needs a notion of projectability between things and facts, between facts and sentences, sorry, the Tractatus solves the problems of philosophy. And this is, if some of you recall, what Wittgenstein says in the preface of his Tractatus, that he has finally solved essentially the problems of philosophy with this rather simple story. But I think there's something interesting here that one has to ask, what were these problems? I mean, why could he say that this is a solution to the problems of philosophy? And I would argue that they concern the possibility of agreement between representation and what is represented. So these are problems of theoretical knowledge or of science, and not of what I would call your working knowledge or of technology. And I want to work this out a little bit further. So what do I mean here? And I'll come back to this again, because it's a very important, in order to identify the deficit that I'm talking about, it's very important to get this, to reiterate that perhaps. So this notion that, you know, what the Tractatus achieves is it shows us that you can be a language skeptic as much as you want. And there were lots of skeptics about language at the time when Wittgenstein was conceiving the Tractatus. There was a crisis of language around the turn of the century in Vienna and so forth. But you can be as skeptical as you like. There's one thing that language can do, right? It can picture, it can be used to picture facts, right? And therefore, you know, with this account, you can, in some sense, establish what Kant would call the fact of science. We can reconstruct the very fact that it is possible to picture the world. And to solve this problem, however, makes certain kinds of assumptions. And first of all, I want to just remind us that this formulation of the problem is deeply ingrained in Kant's philosophy, and that's why I'm saying it's a kind of Kantian conception of metaphysics. Kant, in a letter to Marcus Hertz, which he wrote before he started actually writing down the Critique of Pure Reason, said that he had discovered sort of the question that was the key to all of metaphysics. And that question, which he thought was a novel question, at least in the way he formulated it, was the question, how is it possible that a representation agrees with what it represents, right? So that is the question of metaphysics as Kant conceived it. But it begins, of course, from a certain picture of the mind that is divorced from the world. So there's initially a kind of divorce, which is why we need to forge agreement, right? So there's a kind of skeptical problem that needs to be overcome, right, every time we create knowledge. In some sense, you can use this kind of positivist image that human beings have sense data. I mean, that's how the world presents itself to us. And it is our job to make sense of these data, and we hope that the way we make sense of them somehow actually agrees with how things really are, right? And but this kind of picture of the mind that is divorced from the world, which has been in some sense, of course, ridiculed by many philosophers as a kind of simplistic picture, as a picture that first kind of divorces the mind from the world in order to then say, how can we get them back together? this picture is totally alien to what I would call the philosophy of technology for two reasons. I mean, the first reason is the one that we encountered yesterday when we were discussing Aristotle and Heidegger and so forth and so on. I mean, this human being who is wondering whether from the point of view of sense data, of mental experience, can somehow connect to the world, does not even exist for the kind of builder and dweller that Aristotle and Heidegger are talking about, for those people who, in some sense, through their agency, work themselves into the world, right, and into the things they make. So this is one way in which somehow the philosophy of technology doesn't begin with this notion of a divorced mind. But there is another reason, which is more of a historical reason, that the picture somehow that we're always beginning fresh, so to speak, all we have is sense data, now we have to make sense of them, doesn't seem to be kind of doing justice to, in some sense, the history of the human intellect, as described by philosophers like Charles Sanders Peirce, for example, or philosophers of technology, who look at the world that we actually inhabit as a world that we've made as a world for us. So in other words, everything we figured out about the world, in terms of theory and so forth, is now being, in some sense, worked into the world, and especially through technology. And I would think, actually, the experience of being encountered or being confronted with sense data that we somehow have to, a confusing mass of sense data that we somehow have to make sense of, it takes a lot of work to create this condition today. I mean, you can do this in certain kind of physics experiments where you can create a lot of data and now we have to see how can we sort through this. But this is not our normal experience. Our normal experience is that we have a very structured way of experiencing the world, and it is structured through the ways in which our knowledge, our history is being inscribed technologically into the world. So our condition is not that of the mind that just somehow in a brute way encounters a kind of other outside reality that that we need to reconstruct. So what I want to show here is really that this problem of metaphysics as it was received not just by Wittgenstein, of course, but all his contemporaries and by philosophers of science in the history of metaphysics is peculiarly blind to this position. And I will just make as a quick footnote to this that I could have told the same story about the very famous philosopher of science, Ian Hacking, who many people have said has sort of opened us to a new way of doing philosophy of science in his book Representing and Intervening, and who also ridicules this, what he called spectator theory of knowledge. When it comes right down to it, he says that he wants to say it's not just theory, but also experimental practice to solve the problem of representation. He's very explicit to say that he's not talking about homo faber, he's talking about homo depictor. And he looks at even the simplest forms of carvings that people would make in the early times of, before the human language was invented, the first time someone carved something into a piece of wood, they were making a representation, and they were asking the question, does this agree with reality? Anyway, so let's go to my second step, because time is running us away, but I think we are, okay, I have another 15-20 minutes, right? I don't want to go too long. So very, very quickly, only now, how this actually appears in the Tractatus. I mean, I think I've pretty much drove the point home already about this limited notion of metaphysics, but just to see one way in which it appears in Wittgenstein. Now we don't have to look at the sequence of statements and how they actually, whether they actually follow from one another and so forth. That's a complicated story. But when he says the world is the totality of facts, I mean, why does he say these things? You know, and I think it's interesting that he follows a kind of argumentative line that's almost a reductio ad absurdum, yet you might say, because in 2.212 you see that it would then, if he didn't make all these previous assumptions about the world being the totality of facts, about objects being simple, and all of this, right? If he didn't make these assumptions, it would be impossible to construct a true or false picture of the world. And I think that's his sort of touchstone here, right? And this is very much akin to Kant's project. He says, we begin with the fact of science. We know that we can make pictures of the world, right? I mean, that's the starting point. And now we have to create, to show what the world must be like such that it is a subject of picture. So it is already known to be possible that we can picture the world. We now have to show why we can picture the world and what the world is like such that it is picturable. And here we come to a truly spectacular sentence, I think, in Wittgenstein's philosophy. And this is 4.11 is a sentence that I already kind of referred to implicitly, that there's this notion of the list of true sentences that is the whole description of the world. But much more interesting is 5.4711. To specify the nature of the sentence is to specify the nature of any description. Okay, I can see that part. And therefore the nature of the world. I mean, I think this is really, this addition is really highly revealing for, you know, this conception of metaphysics, right? To say that you are specifying the nature of the world by specifying the nature of the sentence. So here there's a conception of what the world is. You know, the world is that which is the subject of description. That is our conception of the world here that needs to be specified. So all right, so that's one reason why he says the problems have been solved. The nature of the world is specified by specifying what the world must be like, as to be describable, the problem of metaphysics. The nature of the world as it concerns the project of the Tractatus is that it is a describable world. The world of facts is describable because sentences are facts. Again, I mean, this isn't... we express a fact by expressing a sentence. So this is just, again, one aspect that I haven't highlighted so far, but it's... So it's not just that we can somehow create a kind of mapping between different kinds of facts, but ultimately, I mean, there seems to be an almost more original kind of unity that Wittgenstein has in mind here. That when I utter a sentence, I'm making a fact. So a sentence is a fact, and because a sentence is a fact, it has the same logical structure as other facts. It can therefore picture facts. And this is, of course, exactly not how other skeptics of language were operating, right? Who were asking always whether words can express somehow the essence of the thing. Right, and this they cannot. Right, when I say a word, I'm just making a breath of air, and I haven't expressed a thing at all. Right, I mean, I would have to do the Swiftian thing and carry around with me a bag of objects to kind of show them, you know, as an alternative way of communication. Right, Jonathan Swift had that fantasy, you know, that you could carry around in a bag all the items, you know, and instead of saying words, you would show people things. But that would not actually be a good way of communicating in any way at all. and also, I mean, it only highlights the issue that words cannot express things, but sentences can express facts. And that, I think, is one of the crucial insights of Wittgenstein. And we'll come back to that when we talk about things being expressed by works. All right. So here we have the sense in which Wittgenstein has solved the problems of metaphysics as they have been conceived, with all the limitations that I talked about. All right, but now we also know, of course, that Wittgenstein went on and continued that sentence about having essentially solved the problems of philosophy. He continued that sentence by saying, then the value of his work is not actually that it has solved these problems. The value of his work is that it consists in the fact that it shows how little has been done when these problems have been solved. So there are lots of bigger problems around than solving the problem of metaphysics. At least here is Wittgenstein is very, very, very nicely clear about that. We feel that even if all possible scientific questions be answered, the problems of life have not still not been touched at all. These are also statements from the Tractatus. So now there's been so much discussion of what Wittgenstein means here and what else needs to be done. I just want to zero in now, for my purposes, on one aspect of it. So of course people talk a little bit about other ways of expression. You know, what can be expressed in speech is nothing but facts, but there's then all else that we can and that we can wish to express. And so feelings, values, things, we want to maybe express those, but we can't express them in language, because in language you can only express facts. So but in music and in the lives we lead, we can express values, for example. And maybe in technical works we can express things. I'll come to that. There is this whole idea of, I mean, I'm not going to go into this sort of Schopenhauer backdrop to Wittgenstein, right? That he's really talking about the world as a representation, and then there's this whole other story about the world as will, which he hasn't addressed as part of the problems of life. And then there's, this is something I would add, that there is science as true or false theoretical description of the world. He said a lot about that and the possibility of that fact of science. But of course there is still this big gap. A lot has to be done regarding science as acquisition and demonstration of working knowledge, capabilities of technical control of processes and phenomena. And I want to, in terms of these kinds of three aspects of what still needs to be done, so to speak, what little has been done when we, and what lies beyond the work of the Tractatus, I want to now focus especially on this notion of expressing things in technical works and how that actually has something to do with the knowledge production of technoscience. So the world is a totality of facts, not of things, is the second sentence of the Tractatus. And later on he says in the Tractatus, I can only mention the objects. Signs represent them. I can only speak of them. Express them in speech, I cannot. Aussprechen, right? I cannot. And in the notebooks there's a very revealing passage where he says, what if there was something outside the facts? And interestingly enough, he doesn't speak about feelings and values here at this point. He talks about, what if there were things that our senses aren't able to express? Well, there we have the things. And we feel no desire at all to express them in sentences. All right? Now this is very typically a Wittgensteinian kind of, you might call it his kind of quietism. I mean, he says, and the next sentence after this is to say that what we cannot express, we do not express. And sentences are not made to express things, they are made to express facts. And so we express facts and we don't express things in sentences. And we have somehow no desire to express them. And indeed, there is a question here. What is the desire to express things? And I'm not going into that, but I want to ask whether there is a sense in which things are being expressed, and whether this is something that that a philosophy of technology will draw us to. And this is now where I start envisioning this alternative work that hasn't been written. So in the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, we find the sentence that I already quoted. To specify the nature of the senses, to specify the nature of any description, and therefore the nature of the world as the totality of facts. And the Tractatus Technico-Philosophicus might contain the sentence, to specify the nature of the work is to specify the nature of making, and therefore the nature of the world as the totality of things. So this is highly speculative, of course, the claim at this point, and I will only make the first little baby steps towards trying to elucidate that there is a job to be done here and what it would look like to look at the nature of making and building by looking at knowledge of how things work together in a work, and therefore we need to look at what a work is, so to speak, and works are totalities of things. And all right, so what do I mean by work here? In terms of examples, I mean literally clockworks, waterworks, needlework, artwork, works of music, and of course any kind of technological kind of accomplishment, whether it has the word work in it or not. in works, human upbringing, that's sort of my working definition, you might say. In works, humans are bringing things to work together, right? So we are making things work together. And this involves, in some sense, working knowledge, a knowledge of how things work in order to construct, for example, we need this kind of working knowledge in order to make things work together. So when we construct objects, when we repair or tune or temper them in some ways, we are, in some sense, engaging in the ways in which things work together with one another, and we are kind of modifying, modulating, somewhat along the lines of, you know, what Rollo, I think, had in mind with these gears and sticking something in here in order to slow something down there, and stuff like that, right? And this working knowledge issues not in a sentence or theory, but in the work itself and its functioning or performance. So there's a notion, a different, this working knowledge is validated maybe very differently from the way theory is validated. We mentioned this briefly yesterday, right? A theory is validated through its relationship to evidence that has to be accumulated and assessed and evaluated over the course of time, that's always open to critique and improvement and so forth. But there's something about, you know, making something work and knowing that it works, which is much more, in some sense, immediate and self-vindicating. So, and techno-scientific knowledge is, I would argue, working knowledge that consists of capabilities of manipulation, modeling, and visualization. I was referring yesterday to things like knowing how to make carbon nanotubes work in a controlled fashion or something like that. When, in some sense, the business of science becomes, among other things, of course, it's not exclusive, but to a large extent, becomes, in some sense, showing each other what you did in your lab. Look what we did, you know, what we made things do for us. So how are things then expressed by works? Well, works are things, and things can be works. I mean, this is actually somewhat in analogy to saying sentences are facts, and facts can be sentences. So works are themselves things. So we might argue here, you know, where is the thing and where is the work, right? It depends on whether we want to go down to the level of the little gears and wheels inside, or whether we want to look at this once again. This is also a thing, right? It's not just, but it happens to be a work. Because there are somehow more elementary things within this composite thing, right? The work expresses a thing also just like because it is one. Now what would this actually mean? And am I putting too much weight here on the notion of expression? I mean, these are, I'm open to critique about this, and we'll talk about this later. What might this mean? Obviously it's not a kind of end in itself to express a thing, right? I think to talk about expressing in terms of articulating, in terms of making or sort of externalizing and assigning roles and so forth and so on. I mean, this is what I mean. I mean, it's not so much that somehow we have this expressive sort of aesthetic desire to express things. That's not the point. But that it has to do with the notion of articulation, of showing in some sense what things can do, right? So this is what the work does, right? I mean, if it helps, you might say it helps the little cogwheels show what they can do in fulfilling a kind of functional role, for example. So working knowledge makes things to show what they can do, and if you want to say, you can see I'm kind of groping here to see how far I want to go towards certain kinds of analogies between technical works and organisms, functioning in terms of affordance. So what is it actually that is being expressed when I say a thing is being expressed in a work? Other than that somehow there's a part whole, what I would call in German Wirkzusammenhang, right? There's a context of work that is performed together by all the parts. All right, so this is must be very frustrating, I'm sorry, but I'm frustrated myself that this is, of course, it indicates that here, in some sense, we are at the very beginning, in part because there's a lot of philosophy of artifacts which can be worked into this, but at the same time, I try to excuse myself by saying that the problem of metaphysics, you know, as Kant and Descartes used to conceive this, is kind of has an unfair advantage because they've had 2,000 years, whatever, to think about this. And in some ways, these problems are problems that we're just, in some sense, putting on the agenda, or at least again at this point. So that's my excuse. So now let's see how actually the Tractatus might help us, and this might be the last few slides here. So so what would the envisioned Tractatus Technico-Philosophicus look like? What might it incorporate from Wittgenstein's approach, and how does it change our image of science? I don't want to say too much here, just a general conclusion in some sense. As for the Tractatus, we find that already, I pointed out this one analogy, that there is a facts can express facts, and therefore also sentences can express facts, because sentences are facts. things can express things, and because works are things, works can express things. So this is a kind of analogy, and here we might really ask what is meant here by expression. I mean, this is not something about subjective expression of mental kind. It's not a mental concern. Expression has to do something to do with objectification, with articulation, exteriorization, whatever you call it, externalization. The second aspect is that in the Tractatus, the accomplishment of picturing requires, in some sense, no further evidence. It is actually a kind of epistemology of achievement, gelingen, I would say, in German. Right? We can see that a picture is a picture of what it pictures. I mean, this is, in some sense, the ideal that Wittgenstein goes after, right? That once I understand, I mean, of course I need to know what a word represents, for example, what kind of thing a word represents. But once I know what words represent in a sentence, and I can just see the sentence here, and I see a kind of state of affairs or here, then I can see that they're the same. I mean, it's sort of this immediacy that requires, in some sense, no further evidence. And there is here, kind of, I think, a similar kind of immediacy of evidence that is in the working of the device. So in both cases, you might say, there is a kind of the kind of skeptical problem that also motivated some of these metaphysical concerns about the relationship of mind and world are being displaced by this, in some sense, immediacy of accomplishment. Which is why another blind spot in Wittgenstein's work, it's not actually a blind spot, but it's actually very, very difficult, and is how he actually does talk about theories and about general sentences that hold for long times, right? The first image that one has of Wittgenstein's world is that it's a different world every time anything changes, right? So if I take this cup and put it here, right, there's a different fact created, and so the totality of facts that make up the world is a different one. So in some sense, there is really, in the Tractatus, it's actually very difficult to account for continuities over time that are expressed by the truth of theories. So this is a kind of just a superficial kind of analogy that justifies perhaps why I'm still referring here to Wittgenstein, why I think that this Tractatus Technico-Philosophicus might be in some ways a similar work. But I want to finally get to the question of an inversion of perspectives and also how it can be motivated by just one very interesting passage in Wittgenstein's Tractatus, and that will be my last point in this presentation. So this inversion of perspectives can be shown in different ways. I'm making just a quick excursion to a field that I haven't been talking about at all here, but just to kind of indicate how the appeal of this inversion. So So Patrick Maynard, a philosopher of photography, said that, you know, philosophy of photography has gone fatally wrong, he says, by everyone staring at the pictures, you know, the photographs, and then asking all kinds of questions about their realism or constructiveness and stuff like that. And so we have, so we already from the beginning bring in our sort of normal visual experience, and we hold that against what the photograph provides, and now we look at it as a technical artifact that has related to natural vision and so forth. And we get into all these problems of realism and constructivism, problems of metaphysics. But a better starting point would be to look at photography as a technology of measuring and recording light, including invisible light. I mean, the case of making pictures, like photographs that we put into our albums, is only a special case of using the technology of photography. And once we start, in some sense, looking at it as a special case, we can maybe address other questions to it. Namely, then it becomes a certain way of using or designing the use of this technology that maybe is, meets certain kind of criteria, certain expectations of performance. And in some ways, there's an interesting similarity in Wittgenstein's account of language, at least in, again, one passage that I want to show you in a minute. In models and sentences, we playfully and technically configure the elements. And we then can discover that these configurations can be used to picture. So it's not like we are trying the purposes to make pictures all the time of what the world is like. It's a kind of a discovery that we have something at hand that, due to its sort of makeup, due to its sort of logical structure, can be used to picture, and suddenly sentences can be used actually to say something. And I think the same would be true for philosophy of technoscience, right? It would not say that science is the attempt to make a true description of the world. It would begin, in some sense, again, this is the story we had yesterday, that research consists in making things work together. And of the many ways that we can make things work together, some of them are just technical artifacts that raise no metaphysical issues whatsoever, is to make them do what things also appear to be doing on their own. And then we can say, all right, so this is one way to use sort of our tinker with things. We can try to make models of reality, right? And that's just one way in which to use our models, our descriptive apparatus. So the construction of a representational system for exhibiting lawful relations might be a kind of technical design work that draws things together in a very particular way. Representations are one way of using a certain technology to make representations. I want to indicate this last point from Wittgenstein, and again, maybe I'm overemphasizing it, because it brings out also peculiarist, I think, modernist and almost ironical aspect of Wittgenstein's philosophy. So, because I want to say that in the Tractatus, there is a notion that tinkering and play produces a fact that we can then serve, that can then serve as a picture. And I have two evidences for that. The one evidence is right here, the sentences from the Tractatus, where he says, in the situation, in the sentence, a situation is as it were put together experimentally. So Probeweise is actually the German word. Probeweise has a lot more connotations than just the scientific experiment in a way of tinkering. It could also be almost like a theatrical rehearsal type thing. So one name stands for one thing, another for another thing, and among them they are connected. So the whole presents like a living picture, like a tableau vivant, the state of affairs. So this actually, to me, has almost like a dance form. I mean, one name stands for one thing, the other for another, and they all move together in some ways. And just as you do in this kind of fun kind of social game where people kind of try out poses and then they freeze suddenly and we start trying to guess what are you representing, it's a kind of similar kind of story here, right? You're in some sense you're playing with words, you're playing with language, and you can then figure out or can then exploit the fact that, yeah, actually I can make this thing stand for that thing and this thing stand for that thing, and now they represent a state of affairs. And one other evidence that I have for this has actually to do with the very, very origin of the picture theory of language itself. People have always pointed to the fact that Wittgenstein read in a newspaper about a case in a Paris courtroom where toy models were used to model a traffic accident. And this is often presented as if this was Wittgenstein's aha experience, eureka, right? So he was looking to solve the problem of representation, and here he read this thing in the newspaper. They were using car models to represent a traffic accident. Maybe there's a key here, because now I can, if only I understand that making car a model out of toys is not so different from using words and making a model. So this is often how the story is presented, but in a later manuscript, Wittgenstein goes back to this situation and he shifts the emphasis a little bit and says that what he found striking is that these were toys. I mean, these were toy cars, and people used them to play with their little toy cars, in a sense, right? And what they did is to say, you know, and of course when kids play with toy cars, they create accidents and everything, but they don't necessarily mean to represent accidents. And that this is just this kind of additional feature that was being, in some sense, discovered. Hey, we can make these toy kind of these games also use them for the very specific purpose of representation. So representation becomes, in a sense, a special case of a larger kind of technological activity. Cool. So there we have here a felicitous configuration or collection of things that work together, sometimes to picture, but always to afford something or another, in a mechanical work as well as in a work of music, or of course in a work of All right, so I'll return you to this picture. I'm not going to say anything about this, and I'll end the presentation.